Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary, Capitol Hill Baptist Church. Located just blocks away from the center of American power, has a rich 150-year history. Its members have participated in significant world events, advocated for religious freedoms, and spoken out against the moral failings of the times. The story of this congregation features a diverse cast of characters, including a scheming pastor, a female evangelist, and the pastor whose mind was changed by Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. Through their compelling stories, a new book, A Light on the Hill, illustrates how God works through the complexities, uncertainties, and triumphs of the local church. Caleb Murrell explores themes like pastoral ministry, faithfulness, courage, racial reconciliation, and the intersection of church and politics to reveal the lasting effect of faithful church ministries. As readers delve into the story of Capitol Hill Baptist Church, they will learn about its deep impact on evangelism and be inspired to support local churches and the next generation of faithful believers. And joining me on the podcast today is Caleb Murrell, the author of the book, A Light on the Hill. How are you, brother?
Hey, doing great, Jared. It's good to be with you here at Midwestern.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Now, I don't see it here in your bio. Oh, it is in your bio. You're a doctoral student in historical theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary.
And here we are.
Look at that. You actually put it in the official bio. I'm sure they maybe give you some credit for that. I don't know. Let me ask you about CHBC and the inspiration for the book, because I think our listeners know that we are a Nine Marksy podcast. They know that we're, to a large extent, a Nine Marksy institution. So they would not be unfamiliar with, you know, the ministry of Mark Dever and Jonathan Lehman and the Nine Marks crew. And so the connection, obviously, to Capitol Hill Baptist Church. But you're a member there, yes?
That's right. Yeah. A member since 2013.
Okay. So I've been a member there for 12 years now. And you knew that there was some treasure buried in those closets, perhaps, more than what we just see in the present iteration.
It was either treasures or skeletons. I wasn't sure which one.
Well, you usually find both when you start digging through old church closets. So tell me, first of all, what inspired you to think, I want to know about the history of this place, not just the present ministry impact of this place.
Yeah, I think since becoming a member there, and I was an undergraduate major in history, and I think I had a growing sense of an appreciation for the legacy of the church and its rich past that I wanted to explore it. And I had the opportunity to do so on a few occasions, most significantly while teaching through our church history class while on staff at the church. I just decided, you know, we always wrapped up our 13 weeks in church history, kind of tracing 2,000 years of church history, and we ended with a class on the history of Capitol Baptist Church. But it was like three paragraphs written by Bruce Kiesling back in the 1990s.
Okay.
And I was like, this isn't really a class. This is just the information on our history from the website. So I was like, let me go find the minute books and let's just, you know, take a look.
Legit.
And I'm going to teach this class. And I was able to pull together some materials that were really, I thought were interesting and other people found edifying. And just tell a little bit more of the story of the woman who called together a prayer meeting in her home to pray for a Baptist church to be started on Capitol Hill. You know, we knew something about her, that she was remembered as a widow. She was remembered as a washerwoman at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. But like, what was her story? And as I started to kind of dig into some of these details, give more of the texture of the characters and the different challenges the church went through, the staff and elders just gave the feedback like, man, this was so edifying. I think this could be like a larger project, like maybe even a book. Mm. And then they just said, well, would you be interested in writing this? And I was like, yes, I would love to. So they actually gave me two years of staff time.
Wow.
To dig through our archives, to organize the materials, to do interviews, and then to teach the materials to our church. And it was the manuscripts that I taught to the church and got feedback on that became this book. So the book that people will be reading, Lord willing, was first a Sunday school class that our church got to sit through and mostly enjoy.
Well, in some ways, isn't that true to the spirit of CHBC, just how church, you know, the jewel of Christ's crown is this church, this bride that he has paid for and purchased by his own blood.
And so even that the book, the bio about the church would come out of a ministry to the church is such a sweet thing. So you're doing the work essentially of a journalist, historian, archive, like you're literally looking through minutes, meeting minutes, who's at what meetings?
Yeah. When I found our archives, they were in, you know, mostly disarray. I mean, the thing I'm grateful for is we just kept so much stuff.
Yeah.
That was the upside. And then the downside was exactly that. We kept so much stuff. And so just wading through it was overwhelming. And, you know, labeling things, organizing them, being able to cite them. And we ended up, I ended up digitizing about 50,000 pages worth.
Wow.
Just so we wouldn't damage the documents. You know, documents going back to 1874 in the process of, you know, just studying them. And that was the spine out of which the book came. I also did interviews. I consulted other archives and found other sources outside of our own collection. But the bulk of it was our own collection.
Yeah. So when you're looking through minutes, and I'm just thinking back to...
Yeah.
So I pastored a church in Vermont that was started in 1788, I think. It was 200 plus years old. We had archives, and they were actually in my office, and they didn't go all the way back that far, but they went back pretty far. I don't know what would happen to the ancient of documents.
You're going to have to stop me from derailing this interview by just asking you questions about that church.
And every now and again, people would come through.
Interesting.
You know, family, like a minivan will pull up on some summer day and say, we're doing genealogical research, and can we look at your archives? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, and I'd get them out. And I remember I got the notion, I'm going to look through these things to find out, like, what was it like to pastor here? And what I found was just, like, lists of names. Like, these are the people at this meeting. There wasn't any, like, journal or, you know, there was no pastor keeping a record of sort of his life.
True.
So you were actually finding artifacts where people were describing and narrating and those sorts of things?
Yeah. So the membership book that you're describing or the church records, the kind of meeting minutes, that's the spine.
Yeah.
And again, it's hard to get like great narrative out of that. But, you know, every time you see, you know, we know theologically that every name signifies a saint bought with the blood of Christ. So it's of cosmic significance. And yet you can only say that so many times the reader's like, I get the point. But, you know, you look for like who's excommunicated. Do they say what they're excommunicated? Like you're looking for the drama.
Yeah. Okay.
Is there a church split? Is there a new pastor called? You know, church biographies tend to just be a biography of each pastor in succession. What I wanted to tell was the story of the ordinary members. And, you know, I want to tell the story of the pastors, but I also want to give the texture of ordinary members. And you do need more substantial records than what a church book of minutes usually provides. So I relied a lot on newspaper records.
Okay.
I'm doing some genealogical research. You know, anytime I could find memoirs— those were very helpful. I found a few memoirs of pastors or people who had been affiliated with the church. So you got to go where the sources go to be able to tell a story. But, you know, for instance, so we had this washerwoman, Celestia Ferris was her name. You know, I mentioned her a few times. She was born in 1844 in upstate New York. So maybe not too far from where you were pastoring. Came with her family to Washington and grew up in D.C. as the Civil War was going on. So I knew that just from, you know, her birth date and her time in D.C. So I thought, I want to construct the world in which Celestia Ferris grew up, which as a teenager is a war-torn.
Yeah.
So I try to tell the story of different Baptist churches. And then, you know, I found out, you know, she married a Civil War veteran. So I want to tell his story a little bit, find out about the company that he served in. Okay, he was wounded. He saved someone's life. And then, you know, go to the site where they, you know, their first home, where when they got married and that location where they called together the first prayer meeting in 1867. So, you know, you bring all those themes together and with a little bit of inference, you know, you can start to tell a pretty compelling story. And so that's what I try to do. Each chapter is trying to introduce different characters, move the narrative forward, basically just explaining how does God preserve local churches and how do we keep the gospel shining in our generation so that the gospel is still shining in the next generation?
Yeah. Did you find at any point pastoral sort of narratives about? So
yeah, two.
You know,
there's a few.
I thought because of that deficiency at my own church and archives, I thought I'm going to start keeping a journal.
Good.
And then, I scrapped it, Caleb. Because
that happens.
I thought, I want to do for the pastor 200 years from now what I wish this, you know, these guys had done for me. But then I thought I don't want to like preserve and record that so and so was a dirtbag to me and I just felt there was either an ethical or just spiritual, like I'm inscribing down someone's bad behavior. And I don't know what you think about that. Did you came across discipline cases and things?
Yeah.
People didn't have the same compunction that I did, I guess, about that sort of thing.
There's some wild discipline cases that we dealt with and some redemptive ones. So that's chapter two in the book, walks through some of those things. So we had a pastor, Joseph Parker. After we got formed in 1878, in January, we called Joseph Parker to be our pastor. He was one of the most prominent pastors of his day. He was in his 70s at the time. He had pastored two prominent churches in Boston, First Baptist Cambridge, Chalmette Avenue Baptist Church. And we didn't know it, but I found at the University of Virginia Special Collections, he wrote a memoir that was never published, but his personal memoir, and that gave us a lot of texture. He was actually born in Vermont.
Okay.
Cavendish, Vermont.
Oh, wow.
And I'd love to share it with you. I mean, it's such an edifying personal autobiography, but also dealing with his encounters with slavery as a young man teaching in Virginia, and then his experience of conflicts in D.C. during the Civil War, his meetings with Lincoln, just all these things. So, you know, when you find something like that, you're like, this is a treasure trove. And because it intersects with the history of our church, particularly our first pastor, I can weave in this narrative. And so I draw from that in the first two chapters of the book. But yeah, you're right. To tell a good story, you need characters, you need tension, you need drama, and you can only get that from memoirs. The other, we had a pastor in the 1940s, K.O.N. White, who actually his history intersects with this seminary. He goes on to be president of the Southern Baptist Convention, and he writes the article, Death in the Pot, which is reviewing Ellicott's, who was teaching here at the time, his commentary on Genesis. And so he's kind of calling out liberalism in the seminary. Anyway, before that, he was a pastor for us in the 1940s. And because he was president of the Southern Baptist Convention, he did a long-form oral history walking through his experience of pastoral ministry, including pastoring our church. And again, that personal reminiscence shaped some of the narrative as well. So once we got to more recent chapters, I could do a lot more of those interviews. But for those early chapters in particular, I'm having to rely on outside sources, on memoirs to reconstruct the narrative.
Yeah, you know, the contribution of previous iterations of a history of the church can be helpful. The impact even today. So, you know, finding the memoirs, I remember, you know, those minutes were very disappointing for me. But there was, I think, on the 150th, I don't know what that would be called. The 150th anniversary of the church. There was a previous pastor had come in. I forget his name. And he gave an address, and he basically had constructed a history of the Middletown Church.
Wow.
And I learned things that I was able to help, you know, communicate to our church about revivals and different things that they had encountered, connections to the Joseph Smith family and the roots of Mormonism that kind of became the use of divination rods and how the people in our church had to run those people out of town because they were coming around, you know, kind of like leading people astray. And there was this exciting history for a church like mine that needed some encouragement in terms of, can something spiritually vital happen here in Vermont? CHBC is in a very spiritually fruitful place today. So what are some of the stories of, you know, that you've discovered that are impactful, that are helpful even for today for CHBC?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest themes I drew out from the book was how God often works through ordinary people to accomplish extraordinary things. And those extraordinary things appear so only in retrospect, but in the day in, day out, it looks quite ordinary. So, you know, Celestia Ferris calling together a prayer meeting and praying for years before anything got started. You know, they started a Sunday school to evangelize neighborhood kids, and that work lasted for 7 years before the church got started. So, I mean, that's a lot of life where nothing extraordinary is happening. You're being a faithful Christian, you're sharing the gospel, you're praying, and yet the Lord is doing things. He's putting the building blocks in place for a much larger work. And there's so many stories like that throughout the church's history. I think another theme is courage. You know, one story I love to tell is of, you know, after our longest pastor had pastored for 41 years in 1944, the church was looking for a successor, and the pulpit committee brought a recommendation to call a guy who was more compromising in matters related to fundamentalism and modernism. And at the members' meeting, when the pulpit committee presents the candidate, a longtime Sunday school teacher named Agnes Schenkel raised her hand and says, I hear that that canon is actually compromising in matters related to the fundamentalist modernist controversy. And, you know, kind of a hush goes over the room and someone else speaks up and says the same thing. But eventually the pulpit committee withdraws their nomination. And then from the floor, the congregation moves to call a guy named K.O.N. White. And he's the one who'd go on to be president of the Southern Baptist Convention. He would be a noted conservative. But I think that's the turning point when, you know, so many churches in D.C. have gone the well-trodden path toward liberalism, modernism, and unbelief. And I think that's the turning point when, you know, we might have been heading slowly in that direction. You know, it never happens all at once. Mm-hmm. And yet that was the turning point. And it happened because a Sunday school teacher named Agnes Schenkel raised her hand and spoke up. And so just those stories of courage and confidence in God's word to do the right thing.
Yeah. And the congregation guarding.
That's
know,
doing exactly what they're supposed to do.
Doing what they're supposed to be doing. Yeah. That's, amen. The conservative sort of resurgence at my church came after a long period of kind of almost Unitarian light social club. It was a community church, but there was a remnant of evangelical members that wanted a pastor who would preach from the Bible. And so when I came there in 2009, I was only the fourth conservative pastor in a row. From when that time began, they brought a guy named Bob Flower. And he was an evangelical guy, and he started, you know, preaching the Bible. And he ran like townspeople off. They're like, our church was stolen from us by these fundamentalists, and left. But it began the solidifying, the conserving of the church. Tell me about this pastor and MLK's letter from a Birmingham jail.
Sure. So, man, this is a wild story, and we only know about it because Carl F.H. Henry was a member of our church.
Okay.
From 1956 to his death in, I think, 2008 is when he died. Carl Henry, founding editor of Christianity Today, leading theologian of the 20th century. You know, he did that 6-volume work, God, Revelation, and Authority, that I don't think anyone has read the whole thing of, but we're so glad he did it.
I started it ages ago when I was a younger man.
So, my biggest archival discovery was a packet, two folders of Carl F.H. Henry documents in our archives. One of them was Sunday school notes from a class he taught. Hmm. The other one was letters. I mean, you find something like this and you're like, okay, is this my dissertation? But one of the letters was written to our pastor in 1963, just weeks after MLK's letter from the Birmingham jail, where he says, Bill, it took a lot of courage for you to come out so strongly as you did in your sermon on integration. If you could send some remarks to me about your being a Birmingham native and, you know, why you felt this burden, I'd be glad to include it in an upcoming editorial for Christianity Today. And he says, you know, while I don't share all your like optimism or something like this about MLK, he's like, I do think you're absolutely right. We need to be clear on equal rights for African Americans, particularly in public housing. And he mentioned several different areas. But you're like, whoa, like this is, one, it's like a big theme. Like civil rights is a huge story. You know, race relations, Southern Baptist churches.
Yes.
And so you have Carl F.H. Henry writing to our pastor. So getting into that story, it turns out that our church had sponsored a mission to Southeast D.C. in the area known as Anacostia since the 1950s. That area, Anacostia, was quickly becoming a predominantly African-American area. And that chapel, which our church was sponsoring, was dealing with the question of integration. And for a time, we had segregated services where we had a morning service for whites, and we encouraged African-Americans to attend in the afternoon. And that was increasingly becoming a source of public criticism. But our pastor had written to some others, including a professor at Southern Seminary, basically saying like, look, I'm not for integration. I'm not against integration. I do know that if we were to integrate our church, some people would leave. Like, I'm not really sure what to do. And then, you know, it turns out that he preached this sermon. And from like other records, we know that the sermon was entitled The Musts of Jesus. So what does Jesus require of us? And apparently he came out in favor of integration. And shortly after that, the chapel integrated its services. So, you know, I basically, in the book, among other things, I try to deal with how our church handled racial issues in the 1950s and 60s. And I call that chapter, Jesus Doesn't Need a Parking Lot.
Okay.
Because parking lots stood front and center in how our church was relating to changing racial demographics in D.C. And in order, so we didn't have parking lots as a church until 1962. So 80 years of history, no parking lots. Okay. And you ask, why do we need parking lots in 1962? The automobile wasn't invented in 1962. Well, members are moving to the suburbs. Well, why are members moving to the suburbs? Cost of living. Yeah.
Yeah.
Integrated public schools is a big part of it as well. And so, you know, there's dynamics all wrapped up together. And so in 1972, we tore down a historic townhouse that we had bought and the neighbors protested it. And so they carried placards and signs protesting our church. And one of the placards said, Jesus doesn't need a parking lot. So that was the title for the chapter. But basically, like, how do we relate to our neighbors? How can we be good neighbors? And yet, what are some of the ways the church did a good job in responding in this cultural season? And then what were ways where the church could have done better?
Yeah, on that note, so where you're situated, where your church is situated, right in the crosshairs of, I mean, it's the seat of politics, and yet, those who pay close attention, it would seem that Mark in particular, but others also, and the church itself, it would seem, don't seem to get too involved with political, you know, statements. When, you know, I know, you know, a few years ago, Jonathan Lehman took a lot of heat for, you know, some things that he would sort of venture out and to say. But our perception now is that, not that Dever and the church are apolitical, but has a more reasoned, almost that's not our mission stance. How do you do that in Washington, D.C.? And what, I guess, are the implications, or what do you learn from the past that have had any kind of, you know, reverberation into where you are today?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on this. Okay, this could be a whole hour of our podcast.
We got time.
And I think the good thing to know is, I mean, just frankly, like, I don't always agree. I don't agree with Mark on everything politically, or even with her, or Jonathan Lehman. Like, it's not like there's a uniformity.
I'm not asking you to share their political views on here. But yeah,
exactly. But like, there's in some ways, it's easier for us than for other churches. And let me explain why.
Okay.
Our members, not all of them, but many of them, are experts in politics, the political problem. I mean, this is there. So for the pastors to be instructing them in how to do their jobs is kind of like you're pastoring a church in Detroit and you're going to tell the automotive workers now, you know, how to build cars.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that's not entirely fair as an analogy. So we would understand that we are going to give kind of like high level instruction in what the Bible requires, what the Bible teaches. We want to be, you know, giving first principles and explaining to what obedience to Jesus looks like. And yet how you go about best doing that or accomplishing that is going to come down to complex political processes and what you prioritize and otherwise. And so, you know, there'll be members of our church who maybe even work for members of the same political party and yet have different ways of accomplishing the same good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we want to give kind of a high level, but then not get into all the kind of nitty gritty of that. You know, another thing I would say is a culture of meaningful membership, by which I mean understanding that the church is not most fundamentally like a country club or a place where we come to have our needs met, but it is an army where we are serving in the Lord's work. And what that means is it's not always going to be easy, and we're not going to get our own way. Yeah. So we don't come to church with our own agendas and like, I want you to reflect my priorities. We're all coming together to sit under God's word and be changed by it. And I think, that doesn't mean that it's going to be easy, and it doesn't mean that we're going to agree on everything, but we're going to have high level agreement on those first priorities. And
but something like the integration issue, right? I'm going to preach a sermon that's going to address this thing, and there'll be fallout. People will leave. Maybe people will be happy. I mean, this is going to be
There are times
the wedge is there. I'm highlighting the wedge.
There are times when you have to go one way or the other.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think that's all the time, but you know, for instance, so I highlight in the book early on in during the Civil War, pastors got into their pulpit after the firing on Fort Sumter and had to decide: I'm going to pray for those in authority, according to 1 Timothy 2. Am I going to pray for those in authority for the Union and for those in authority? And the Confederates?
Right, yeah, okay.
And that that simple decision is a deeply political statement. If you pray for both, you're legitimizing rebellion.
Yeah.
If you only pray for one. So there are times when churches find themselves in a place where you cannot simply balance. You have to take a clear side and let the chips fall. I think, you know, we felt this way during COVID when you have to decide, are we going to gather? Are we not going to gather? Are you going to understand the government's authority to be legitimate and therefore ought to be obeyed, Romans 13? Or are you going to understand to be illegitimate and therefore we ought not? So again, there are times when there's only two ways to go. And civil rights and integration were one of those things. Are we, you know, are we going to integrate as a church or not? Is this going to be an area where, you know, where we're going to understand God's moral law to be binding in this area? And I think you have to have the courage as a pastor, and you got to pray for unity on your elder board to be able to stake out a position and then to be willing to stand by it, even if it costs you members, even if it means you'll be misunderstood and disliked. And at the same time, that's not all the time.
Sure.
But you at least have to have that willingness when the time comes.
I would imagine, too, as you mentioned, the unique context is, I think, really key. So it's not only that the pastors should think twice before trying to provide high-level instruction and political theory and things that their members, it's part of their vocation, you know, to a large extent, but also even regurgitating or just mindlessly or carelessly co-opting whatever political, you know, however the winds are going in terms of, you know, I'm not going to ape Fox News or CNN headlines, because our people think deeper than that. That stuff that's spun for mass, you know, audiences, and my people are more sophisticated than that.
I think it is challenging, though, because, you know, on the one hand, there is an instinct to say, like, you want to do two things at the same time. On the one hand, you want to relativize the political to emphasize what God is doing supernaturally as of ultimate importance. So the ultimate reality is God's kingdom is coming, and kind of proclaiming that. At the same time, you know, most of our people spend their time working to protect our national security from terrorism, existential threat.
Yeah, how does my faith play out?
Exactly.
In this stuff?
Yeah. So then you wanna do that without delegitimizing the legitimate and very good work that people are doing in their 9-to-5. And I think that does take some wisdom and some tact, but we try to do both of those things at the same time. And we probably don't always succeed, and there's always room to grow.
Yeah, I think some of the pastors, so let me just think it outside of your context, but the average American pastor in particular, they're probably thinking too much. I'm not saying they shouldn't think about this, thinking too much about how to, you know, how do I communicate to my people about presidential politics, et cetera, and not enough about a church member who is having to go to the, you know, diversity training at their workplace. How do I, you know, help him think through that, you know, whether he should go, not go, go with some abstention, et cetera. We're usually thinking at some kind of, I don't know, rhetorical level, and not at the level that our people are actually working through. I want to ask another question about this, about the context, because before we began recording, you were asking if I'd ever, you know, visited, or how often I've visited. And I remember doing a weekender when I was pastoring in Vermont at CHBC, and I learned so much. I took away so much. There were things I was like, oh, this would be great. But I also realized, okay, if I brought this specific practice back to my church, like if I showed up with my elders and said, guys, I want you all to write white papers on IVF, you know, those guys would have looked at me like, you are out of your mind. And yet I remember sitting in an elders meeting. I think it was the issues meeting. I don't know how they're run today, but I think back then they were alternating between sort of issues and pastoral care.
Yeah, still do that.
Yeah. So, and it was, I mean, there was, you know, 20 some guys around a table perhaps, and a few of them had written these, and that was the issue that night was, should our church have a stance on in vitro fertilization? And so there was a conversation, and I think they tabled it at the end. They didn't decide that the church should have a thing at that time anyway. And I thought, this is really impressive and this is really cool, but I think this is really specific to almost like a type A personality culture. And it doesn't mean that my church, that we shouldn't talk about that thing at my church, but I also just saw how context specific. Take me back CHBC history. Are there things that were context specific that have built into what Capitol Hill Baptist Church is today?
Absolutely. One of them would just be the church has generally had a fairly high level of turnover and transplants.
Yeah, transients.
And so you'll get that in an urban setting, but lots of people moving there for work, working for the government, working for the military, working for members of Congress. And so that's had huge upsides, kind of young people, energy coming in. And that's going to shape the life and the culture of the church. One thing people have said consistently that I interviewed well before Mark Dever got there is that the vibrancy of the community, because everyone was leaving their place of origin and coming to a new place, almost like how college is for many people. Like,
yeah.
These are my friends. This is my community. Lots of time together. So rich relationships forming on relative short notice has been consistent. I think that transience has also been a theme. So, you know, there's upsides to that. There's also challenges with that. And so the church is really blessed by those longtime members who haven't just come and moved on, but have come and stayed and have invested in the next generation.
Yeah. Every 4 years or 4 to 5 years, right? If especially we deal with that somewhat here at our church as well, because we're kind of in the student bubble. So we've got a number of like, you almost have a whole new church every 4 to 6 years, it seems like.
And that can be exhausting. That can be tiring. Yeah. You know, we've kind of coined the phrase hugging the parade to describe the experience, okay. Not only of other members, but also, you know, we're a church that is training up and sending out a lot of pastors through our internship program, through the way we structure our staffing. And so, you know, a member once expressed to one of our pastors that it feels like we're being pastored by a parade. And so, you know, just one reality of our present context is, there's challenges for the experience of members in that. Mm-hmm. And like, we're a very kind of high efficiency church. We're sending a lot of people out. We also need to be mindful of the pastoral care that's needed by our own congregation and the sacrifices that they're making in that process. Kind of like a family that's always having people over for dinner every night. Yeah. You know, at some point, the wife might say to the husband, like, hey, I think we need a family night.
Well, that'd be good. And to that point, brother, I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but the impact of, in particular, the last, you know, number of years, the ministry, the reach, the depth of influence that Capitol Hill Baptist Church and Nine Marks Ministries and everything have had. When I think in particular of all the guys I know who've been through the internship and the way they talk about how formative it was, what they can replicate and what they, you know, cannot, the uniqueness, you know, how the Lord has raised up a Mark Dever and put him in that position to shape and form and influence a generation of pastors, to be on, you know, a light on the hill. It has more than one meaning, I think, in this respect, because of Dever's influence. One last thing I want to ask you about.
And just on that, if I may.
Yeah.
And what I want readers to take away from the book is that what you just described, that impact, is to the credit of Celestia Ferris.
Okay.
In heaven.
Hmm.
Like, her crown is brighter for that impact, even though she didn't live to see that day.
Amen.
The crown of Agnes Schenkel is brighter because of
the
that.
The lady who raised her hand in the membership meeting and said, I don't think that he is on the right side of this controversy.
And this is why it is worthwhile for ordinary Christians like you and me to give ourselves to the work of the local church, mm-hmm. because there will not be many Mark Devers. But all of us have a part to play in keeping that light shining for the next generation, and who knows what the Lord will do it. You know, don't despise the day of small things. The Lord does great and extraordinary things through local churches.
I think of particular interest to some of our listeners will be the impact of the Sunday school ministry.
Okay.
Tell me about that story.
Yeah, the church got started out of a Sunday school, and that was fairly common for Baptist churches at the time, 19th century. Sunday school was the front lines of evangelism. That's how you're kind of educating people in the Bible. That's how your literacy is happening for children who don't have access to schools.
Did they have a bus ministry?
We did for much of our history, yeah. And so Sunday school would typically be on Sunday afternoons, and it was the work that members were engaged in between services. They weren't at home watching football, not that there's anything wrong with being at home watching football, but they were gathering the kids from the neighborhood and teaching them the Bible and teaching them songs. That was a big part of the church's history. Well through the 1950s and 60s, you'd often have the Sunday school attendance double that of the Sunday morning attendance, just the number of children in particular. And I think it's important to remember that, like, Sunday school was not childcare for the children of members so that parents can pay attention during the sermon, though I think that's good. I think it's good for parents to be able to pay attention during the sermon.
Sure.
But, I mean, there were a lot of kids sitting through those sermons too, which may have been a little shorter than an hour. But you know, just that evangelistic front lines, man, I wish we could get something of that back.
Yes.
And that there would be just neighborhood children whose parents are willing to send them to a church because they're being educated in the Bible.
Did we lose something in the shift? I know, you know, cultural applications and all those sorts
totally.
Of things, contextual, you know, considerations change things. The, you know, at our church, we don't call it Sunday school. We have it, but it's called equipping groups. I don't know at CHBC. I know they have some version. Is it like Sunday
seminars?
Yeah, core seminars, those sorts of things. So
who knows why we call it that? We're the only church in the world that calls that. But that's so CHBC to like call it
But I think
something.
There's been a recovery of interest at least.
Yeah.
There are certainly churches that are still doing it and feel like, oh, this is a dead thing. We should move to small groups. And in some ways, they're now 20 years behind the return to theological education at the local church level, where churches who did make that move, oh, let's not do Sunday school, let's all do small groups, you know, saw the benefit of, you know, fellowship and life on life community and those sorts of things, but also thought, oh, we're actually maybe losing something by not rehearsing.
It is interesting.
Church polity and the basics of theology and, you know.
Yeah, when you go to churches that were built in the late 19th century or early or mid 20th century, you often have the sanctuary and then you have the Sunday school building. And the Sunday school building is sometimes like
the education wing.
The education wing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you got like tons of classrooms. And that is a statement of what they valued and prioritized. And look, I mean, you don't want to just do the, you know, new wine, old wineskins problem where you just take, you know, that worked then, let's just slap it on now. But I think there's something to say about Bible literacy. There's something to say about civic engagement and using the Bible for evangelistic purposes that could be recovered and applied in our own day in different ways.
That's great. The book is A Light on the Hill, the surprising story of how a local church in the nation's capital influenced evangelicalism. The author is Caleb Morrell. It's now available. A Light on the Hill is available now from Crossway Publishers. You can get it wherever good books are sold. Brother, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
It was a joy to speak with you.
If you enjoy the podcast, dear listener, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church. You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.